Hello, and welcome to this audio edition of Philip Huscher's program notes for upcoming concerts by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. I'm Rich Caparella, and concerts by the CSO on Thursday, May 9th through Saturday, May 11th, feature guest conductor and violinist Nikolai Zepp-Schneider. The program includes Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 2, Liebeslied by Fritz Kreisler, a suite from Pulcinella by Stravinsky, and after intermission, the Prague Symphony No. 38 by Mozart. Here are program notes by Philip Huscher on Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 2, a work lasting about 21 minutes. Mozart had a little violin that he got as a present in Vienna. So begins one of the most celebrated anecdotes about the young Mozart, a child in everything but musical talent. Johann Andreas Schottner, a friend of the family, continues, "We were going to play trios. Papa, Leopold, playing the bass with his viola, Wenzel, the first violin, and I was to play the second violin. Wolfgang had asked to be allowed to play the second violin, but Papa refused him this foolish request because he had not yet had the least instruction in the violin, and Papa thought he could not possibly play anything. Wolfgang said, 'You don't need to have studied in order to play second violin,' and when Papa insisted that he should go away and not bother us anymore, Wolfgang began to weep bitterly and stamped off with his little violin. I asked them to let him play with me. Papa eventually said, 'Play with Herr Schockner, but so softly that we can't hear you or you will have to go.' And so it was. Wolfgang played with me. I soon noticed, with astonishment, that I was quite superfluous. I quietly put my violin down and looked at your papa. Tears of wonder and comfort ran down his cheeks at this scene." Schockner places the evening in January 1763. Wolfgang turned 7 that month. It astonished even Leopold, who can never be said to have underestimated his son's talent. The full range of Mozart's ability still amazes us today, even though we know he played the clavier with grace and fluency at 4, began to compose at 5, and went on to write music of an emotional depth and cerebral level, often at odds with his age and behavior, and comprehensible only as the work of absolute genius. 1 month after Wolfgang played with Herr Schockner, Mozart performed on both violin and harpsichord in concert for the Salzburg court. From then on, he played second fiddle to no one. Often during the 1770s, Mozart appeared as a violin soloist in Salzburg, Vienna, Augsburg, and Munich. In 1777, he wrote home to his father from Munich, "I played as if I were the greatest fiddler in all of Europe." Leopold wrote back that if he would only apply himself, he might indeed sound like the first violinist of Europe, and pointed out that many people do not even know that you play the violin, since you have been known from childhood as a keyboard player. Shortly after that, Wolfgang dropped the violin in favor of the keyboard for concertizing and the viola for playing chamber music, partly to spite his father, who made his name as a violinist and who had published an influential and popular treatise on violin playing the year his son was born. Wolfgang rightly knew that he was the more precious product of 1756. Although Mozart wrote music for solo violin throughout his career, sonatas, sets of variations, mini concertos, embedded with orchestral serenades, the centerpiece of this output is the set of 5 concertos he composed in the mid-1770s in Salzburg, and no doubt designed to perform himself. It used to be assumed that these 5 works were written in the span of just 8 months. The earliest is dated April 14, 1775, on the autograph, the last December 20, 1775. But recent scholarship suggests that the last 2 digits of those dates were tampered with more than once, first adjusting them to read 1780 and then to 1775. It now seems likely that the last 4 do date from 1775, but the first concerto might have been written as early as 1773. In any event, all 5 concertos are early Mozart. They predate his first significant piano concerto in E-flat major, K271, by more than a year, but they aren't immature works in any sense. This concerto in D major is the first of the four that Mozart composed in the second half of 1775. It's tighter and more economical than his first concerto, written as much as 2 years before, which suggests that Mozart was now advancing in a form that was still new to him. When the work was published for the first time in 1802, it was titled Concerto Facile, Easy Concerto, which is more a comment on the early 19th century attitude toward older music than on its technical challenges. Beethoven's only violin concerto, full of the romantic drama and virtuoso flair of the new era, dates from 1806. Mozart's D major concerto is a particularly unshowy and self-effacing work, but it's neither undemanding nor simplistic. This is the Mozart who was most easily dismissed by later generations who failed to appreciate the unerring skill, the delicate balance, and the always surprising ingenuity in which he worked in the classical style. Even Mozart himself, in his late works, moved far beyond the tidy perfection of these early scores as he broke rules and overturned convention in his search for deeper expression. But there's nothing commonplace about a piece like this violin concerto, despite its polished veneer and cheery disposition. The opening allegro is a case in point, for although it begins with an utterly conventional theme, it takes off in ways no one but a composer of Mozart's caliber, and who else at the time other than Haydn fits that description, could have imagined. The Andante is a gracious opera aria, more formal and restrained than those of the later operas. This is the Mozart of La Finta Giardiniera and Il Re Pastore, after all, and a full decade before The Marriage of Figaro. La Mero, the famous soprano aria from Il Re Pastore, written earlier in the year, is cut from the same cloth as this Andante and even features a solo violin obbligato. The charming finale is built around a recurring minuet of courtly grace. Program notes by Philip Pusher on Mozart's Violin Concerto No. 2. And now on to a suite from Pulcinella by Igor Stravinsky, the suite lasting about 20 minutes.
How odd Stravinsky's Pulcinella must have sounded in 1920. Charming, witty, disarmingly simple 18th century music from the man who had shocked Paris only 7 years earlier with the fierce modernism of the Rite of Spring. But Pulcinella was also, in its own way, radical. Stravinsky seemed to be saying that the music of the future might well learn from the lessons of the distant past. Pulcinella is usually credited as the first music of neoclassicism. It did certainly signal a shift in Stravinsky's own thinking that served him well for years to come. Pulcinella was my discovery of the past, the composer wrote, the epiphany through which the whole of my late work became possible. It was a backward glance, of course, he later said, but it was a look in the mirror, too. For all its importance to Stravinsky's musical development, the idea for Pulcinella was not his, but that of the great Russian impresario Sergei Diaghilev. By 1919, Diaghilev and the young composer were no longer on the best of terms, and Diaghilev was determined to patch up their differences and revive the collaboration that had produced the Firebird, Petrushka, and the Rite of Spring. One spring afternoon, when he and the composer were strolling in the Place de la Concorde, he proposed that Stravinsky take a look at some 18th century scores with the idea of orchestrating them for a ballet. When he said that the composer was pergolesi, I thought he must be deranged, Stravinsky later remembered, thinking unhappily of the Stabat Mater and the opera La Serva Padrona. Finally, Stravinsky promised to at least take a look. I looked, and I fell in love, the composer recalled. And so the two men began to plan. Diaghilev showed Stravinsky a manuscript dating from 1700, which he had found in Italy. The subject of its many comic episodes was Pulcinella, the traditional hero of the Neapolitan Commedia dell'arte, and a perfect focus for the action of their own 18th century ballet. Meanwhile, Stravinsky had been sifting through the pile of manuscripts that Diaghilev had thrust in his hands, picking and choosing among trio sonatas, assorted orchestral works, and operatic selections, some of which not even by Pergolesi, as we have since learned. Then, Stravinsky set to work in a fashion entirely new to him. I began by composing on the Pergolesi manuscripts themselves, as though I were correcting an old work of my own, he later wrote. I knew that I could not produce a forgery of Pergolesi because my motor habits are so different. At best, I could repeat him in my own accent. What Stravinsky created was, in fact, something entirely his own. He left Pergolesi's bass lines and melodies alone, but the inner harmonies, the rhythms, and the sonorities all bear Stravinsky's stamp in one measure after another. The remarkable thing about Pulcinella, Stravinsky later said, is not how much but how little has been added or changed. His achievement, then, is all the more remarkable. The music was misunderstood from the first rehearsals. Diaghilev, expecting a harmless adaptation like Respighi's recent tribute to Rossini, La Boutique Fantasque, was shocked. He went about for a long time with a look that suggested the offended 18th century. Diaghilev was not even sure whether to acknowledge Stravinsky as the composer of Pulcinella or merely as its arranger. Stravinsky had the last word. I was attacked for being a pasticheur, chided for composing simple music, blamed for deserting modernism, accused of renouncing my true Russian heritage. People who had never heard of or cared about the originals cried sacrilege. The classics are ours. Leave the classics alone. To them all, my answer was and is the same. You respect. I love. The ballet had its premiere at the Paris Opera House in May 1920. The choreography was by Lénine Massine, with scenery and costumes by Picasso. The collaboration of these two had been part of Diaghilev's lure. This was Picasso's third assignment for Diaghilev, following Parade, with music by Erik Satie, and Manuel de Falla's The Three-Cornered Hat. This dream collaboration was no picnic, however. Diaghilev asked Picasso to redo the designs twice, and at one point threw his drawings on the floor and stomped on them. In the end, according to Diaghilev biographer Richard Buckle, the finished result, a Neapolitan street scene conceived in cubist terms and painted blue, gray, dark brown, and white, the houses framing a view of the bay with a boat, Vesuvius, and the full moon, is one of the most beautiful stage settings ever made. The stunning white floor had to be repainted for each performance. Pulcinella was a triumph, one of those productions, the composer reported, where everything harmonizes, where all the elements, subject, music, dancing, and artistic setting, form a coherent and homogeneous whole. Yet only the music endures today. According to the composer, Picasso's backdrop ended up in storage at the Paris Opera, where it faded irrevocably, save for the moon, quote, whose yellow had been renewed in part by a cat. In his old age, Stravinsky said that Pulcinella was the only work of Pergolesi's that he really liked. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Pulcinella by Igor Stravinsky. And now on to Mozart's Symphony No. 38, the Prague Symphony. The work lasts about 23 minutes. There are more sketches for the Prague Symphony than any other by Mozart, starts and stops and doodling for all the movements, even an opening for the finale, which eventually was discarded. This was Mozart's first symphony in 3 years. His struggle, however, wasn't with the form, which he had mastered long before, but with the desire to say something important and new. This great D major symphony was written for Prague, where Mozart was something of a folk hero. Music from his newest opera, The Marriage of Figaro, was whistled on the streets and played at dances and balls. Even the alehouse harpist had to add Cherubino's Non più andrai to his repertory. The symphony was written in the 18 months between the premieres of Figaro and Don Giovanni, and it finds Mozart working on an operatic scale in purely orchestral music and reaching for a more deeply expressive language. The opening of the Prague Symphony is highly dramatic music, full of power and that peculiarly alarming Mozartean undercurrent of tragedy. This adagio is arguably the most profound and fully realized symphonic introduction before Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, and it certainly marks an advance over the slow beginning of Mozart's own Linz Symphony, written 3 years earlier. Even Prague audiences who doted on Mozart's every move and were surely willing to give him the benefit of a doubt must have wondered what Mozart was up to in these first 36 measures of music. Our advantage is a familiarity with Don Giovanni, which Mozart would soon introduce in Prague, and which obviously was on his mind. Don Giovanni's fingerprints are all over this music. Listen to the tread of the surging basses, the heart-stopping drum rolls, the suspenseful wind chords, and even the rising chromatic scales. An introduction of this breadth and significance demands a substantial, big-boned allegro, and Mozart does not disappoint. Mozart is working here on the largest scale. This is one of his most spacious sonata allegro movements, and with an astonishing abundance of thematic material. In the first 16 bars alone, there are at least 4 perfectly good ideas, and although Mozart continues to use and develop these, he spins out new material at every turn. Melodic ingenuity is at the highest level throughout. The bassoon accompaniment to the second theme, for example, quietly alludes to the first. Mozart's concept of sonata form is flexible and creative. The exposition ends unexpectedly with material first heard earlier in the movement. The development section tosses out a couple of false leads regarding the return to home base, and the recapitulation is cavalier about restating events in their original sequence. There are moments in the development section when every instrument contributes to a contrapuntal web as dazzling as that in the celebrated finale of the Jupiter Symphony. The whole is a great intellectual achievement presented in the good-natured grace of one who is very comfortable with his exceptional talent. The most remarkable thing about the Andante in G without trumpets and drums is the way one lovely idea succeeds another in the most logical progression. There's enough material here to last a lesser composer a lifetime. Mozart presses forward as if he believes he will never run out of ideas. After the power and energy of the first movement, the Andante seems uncharacteristically placid. But Mozart draws the listener in until the simplest of gestures, even the gentle rise and fall of the interval of a second, carries extraordinary emotional weight. The Prague Symphony is known in Germany as the Symphony without a minuet, and in fact, it's the only one of Mozart's last 6 symphonies that follows the serenity of the slow movement directly with the bustle of the finale. The Prague audience surely recognized the composer of their beloved Figaro in this last movement. The opening is the same music as that of the breathless duet in which Susanna tries to stop Cherubino from jumping out the window. The form here is a hybrid between sonata allegro and rondo that's neither, though it's thoroughly delightful and inventive music. There's a wonderful moment in the development section when the violins seem to have fallen behind the beat and scurry after the cellos and basses, causing a frightful series of dissonances. Finally, Cherubino makes his jump and lands squarely on both feet to the D major cheers of the full orchestra. Program notes by Philip Huscher on Mozart's Prague Symphony, the Symphony No. 38. My name is Rich Caparella. Thanks for listening.